Welcome Underground. Coincidentally, we have both suffered recent and quite bad shoulder injuries. In this episode, we discuss what that has meant to us and what we have learned from the experience. For both of us, it was a reminder that our time on this earth is finite, but that's probably not a bad thing to have at the back of one's mind if you're to live well and live healthily. Enjoy.
So today we're going to talk about injuries because I am injured and you've recently been injured. Do you want to just tell the reason about your injury first? Because yours was first in time. So I feel like...
It was. And I'm sort of coming to the end of it now as well. I hurt my shoulder in the garden. Bro, I've done lots of stuff where like, if I'd injured myself doing it, it'd been like legit. Everyone would have said, yeah, that kind of makes sense. Yeah. This was literally just falling off a little ledge in my garden. And it wasn't even the impact of the bottom that broke my shoulder. It was catching myself and heroically preventing myself from hitting the bottom. And that yanked my arm up so hard that top bit of the... I still don't know what it's called. The kind of ball bit in the wound and socket.
Yeah.
The greater globular something. So a bit of that kind of snapped off. But basically, the arm was wrenched up. And so the tendon was put under a lot of stress. And instead of breaking the tendon or ripping the tendon off the bone ripped apart instead.
Does that mean that you've got like madly strong tendons? Or does it mean you've got embarrassingly weak bones?
I think if you're young, it's the bone that breaks. If you're old, it's the tendon that breaks. So I think this was, the whole thing was a rather sobering reminder of my immortality. It was heartening that I got the young person version of the injury old person is.
I feel like you're on the cusp. It's an interesting one.
You're quite lucky. 6 months. So.
Yeah. You're quite lucky that they didn't like both break or something. You just between the two, aren't you?
Yeah. But apparently this is all very good news. When I went to the surgeon, I got an MRI scan and everything. And then when I came in the next time, he said, "Great news, you've broken your shoulder." I'm like, how on earth is that great news? And he was like, anything else that could have been would have been far worse. Because as soon as you get tendon damage and things like that, then you're looking at a big operation and years of recovery and probably never getting full movement back whilst the fracture heals. So I get zero sympathy from anyone who's had a proper shoulder injury. And it turns out lots of people have. So while I was bitching about my broken shoulder, they're like, "Oh, did you have an operation?" I'm like, "No." "Was there any tendon damage?" "No." "Oh, you call that a shoulder injury?" And then they look into space.
Nevertheless, though, it was a serious injury, wasn't it? What was the consequence of being? He's knocked you out of your hobbies and pastimes for a little bit of time, hasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's been 4 months of jiu-jitsu, although I'm probably a week or two away from starting that up again.
It's very exciting.
It really hurt at the time.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to tell the listener about how you reacted to this? First of all, you've missed out my favourite detail of this entire story, which is your description of why it happened.
I knew this ledge was a safety hazard. I'd ordered the sort of safety rail to go on it, which was there in the way in my garden. So I was squeezing past the safety rail along this ledge. and slipped off.
And the phrase, "I went 100% and it turned out," what was it? "My knee was only at 99% or something."
I had torn some muscle in my leg while kite surfing, which is much more legit, but much lower severity. And it wasn't fully healed yet. And I often bounce along that ledge because I'm used to it. With a 90% leg, it let me down when it would have been better if it hadn't.
Yeah.
So
sad times. Brilliant. Okay. You've had 4 months of being off jiu-jitsu and it was pretty painful, wasn't it? I mean, you couldn't lift your arm for quite a while.
Yeah, no, I mean, I tried to grizz it out initially. So I did a whole day of work and then my wife shouted at me. So I wandered over to A&E. Got put right at the bottom of the triage queue because I was like, I did it this morning and I don't need any extra painkillers. It's probably fine. So I had a nice 4-hour wait, which I thought was outrageous. but I've since been told that 4 hours in A&E is it's a really good run.
Yeah. So, and you've kind of got yourself to blame there, haven't you? Refusing pain medication and sort of wandering in late in the day after doing it in the morning. Just being that, you know, Billy big boy of like, oh yeah, like I don't need any paracetamol. I'm fine.
Yeah, as you know, I've got this absurd sense of honor where painkillers. I don't know. I think at some impressionable age, someone told me that painkillers were bad, or that you were weak for taking them. Or you should grow up and not take painkillers.
Was it your father?
Plausibly.
Or was it your brother?
No, it wouldn't be him. I think he learned a lot because he's actually a pro at injuries. Because this is my first major injury as well, so it was all discovery for me. But I think any seasoned veteran has long learned that just take the pinkers. it actually speeds up your recovery and means you're going to use it a lot more because it doesn't hurt. So long as he's not doing any actual damage, then having it not hurt is better than having it hurt.
Yeah.
I acknowledge that.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Okay, good. And so it was quite painful for quite a long time, but coming out of it now. So what do you want to do? Do you want to talk about what you've learned or should we talk about my...
let's do yours because it's fresh. So when I did this, extremely painful. And it was like, as soon as I did it, I was like, something's gone wrong here. I had that definite feeling.
Yeah.
And then obviously waited a day before going to... anyway, but like
just to make sure
I knew, yeah,
you knew deep down. And also, yeah,
well, once the initial pain is subsided, like if I wasn't using the shoulder, it was fine, at rest, it was fine, especially when it was in a sling. It was only when I wanted to use it that I had problems. But the problem is, you've got to use it to get it better, so you're actively seeking out the pain to speed up recovery, which was
nice. That'd be right up your street. That's kind of suits you psychologically a little bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it was also fighting, though, especially once I had a physio giving me exercises. It's like I was never one to do homework or or revision. And this fell into that, or music practice. Mm-hmm. And this fell into that category of just stuff I will ignore. until my physio managed to scare me a few weeks down the line with the possible consequences. Mm-hmm. Apparently... your shoulder, there's something like gluing or shoulder, there's some glue syndrome or something like that where your shoulder just glues up and then you never get full range of movement back, and that then overrode my dislike of homework because it confronted me again with my mortality.
I can imagine that. Yeah, that's a scary thing to hear.
So then I started doing all my exercises.
And nobody wants glue shoulder, do they? That sounds rubbish.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it sounds both rubbish, but also like you know exactly what it means.
Yes.
You're not hiding behind technical terms there.
No. So my injury, I don't know whether I can even grace it with the name injury, but I've done something to that. I don't know what it is, but about a week ago, it just started really, really hurting, like a lot. And hurting to move it, hurting at rest, hurting like no matter what position it's in, and initially when this happened, actually it was actually a couple of weeks ago, it just started, but then I woke up with it feeling very stiff and it was actually the same type of pain, but then it just kind of went off and I thought, I must have slept funny on my shoulder, how weird. And so I continued with my normal activities, which, you know, they do involve, it does involve a fair amount of exercise and sort of a few weights and jiu-jitsu and all of that kind of thing. And I had a pretty intense session of jiu-jitsu on sort of the Friday. It was no-gi and we were doing...
Check you out.
Well, it was by accident. Our professor had switched around the gi and no-gi schedules. So I just walked up and it was like, oh, it was no-gi. I was like, okay, I guess I'm doing my first session of no-gi. It started off...
Do you want to explain what no-gi is?
No-gi is not wearing the sort of the kimono and the sort of the classic sort of martial arts
pajamas.
Gown, pajamas, yeah. So you do it with just a sort of a modern sort of athletic-y top on that's kind of close-fitting. So it's kind of more... It's a bit faster moving and my impression of it is, having only done it once, that it is more intense than the gi, just because you have fewer grips to slow you down.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Because you spend all that time learning all the chokes and things that involve holding... the other guy's pajamas, and then suddenly they're not wearing pajamas, and
and
it turns out the alternatives are a lot harder.
Yeah, and also you get very, it's much more. I don't know. It's a bit gross, but it's slippy, isn't it? Because everyone's very sweaty, and you're sort of there's nothing to absorb the sweat. And so it's kind of like I always describe jiu-jitsu as like technical wriggling, but this is it like you know, gi is like technical wriggling. Sort of covered in sweat, technical slipping, or something like that. But I don't know. At our bar, for the no-gi classes, you always roll starting from standing, which is more intense as well because you got to go through the takedown process. whether you are doing it or having it done to you, it's quite an intense process.
Yeah, either way.
it was pretty full on. I had a great time. And funnily enough, I kind of sprained my wrist while I was doing it. I thought, I've sprained my wrist. Classic. You know, I know what that feels like. That's fine.
Yeah.
It'll take a few days to heal. But that was what was on my mind. So I wasn't thinking about my shoulder at all. But the next day, my shoulder just started to hurt a little bit. And I was like, oh dear, I've done something to my shoulder as well. And then the next day, it got worse. And then the next day, it got worse. and so on and so forth until, at points during this week, it's been really, really... I've really struggled with the pain to the point where I'm not really able to sort of really function very effectively kind of doing anything.
Is it your left or right?
It's my left, yeah. And it got to the point where I was sort of thinking, oh my God, this is actually really painful. And it's not going away. But I did the sort of fatal thing of Googling, but I'm glad I did actually.
No.
Because I looked at the symptoms and I was, it seems to me, not being a trained physician or anything, it seems to me a pretty dead set for tendonitis of the biceps tendon, which is where, and again, forgive me, any medical listeners, is where basically the muscles, I like to think of it, the muscles are so strong and so manly and so intense that they like basically just rip apart the tendon. Not rip it apart, but just kind of squeeze it and sort of distress it and, you know, do things to it. It's like somebody is twisting a knife in my shoulder all the time, which is a great feeling.
Have you also learned how much you use your shoulder?
It's all the time, yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. Like, just
turns out
for everything.
For most things.
So it's horrible. I can't do anything. Like, I can't. The only exercise I can currently do is walking. I mean, it's embarrassing. I can't even go for a run. I went for a run the other day thinking, oh, maybe that'll just loosen it up. Honestly, the next day, the pain was so bad.
I mean, mine was my right shoulder. I even had to learn how to wipe my ass with my left hand. Yeah. Which after how many years on this earth?
Every day's a school day.
Yeah. It was more difficult than I expected. Anyway.
Turns out it's a highly developed skill, clearly. Yeah.
One you don't think about.
Yeah.
There are like lots of these things. Yeah, I choose that one for its shock value, but like everything.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, it is bad. I mean, the worst is putting clothes on. Oh my God. I mean, the shirt is your friend if you've got a shoulder injury. You know, you just unbutton it and you just slide it on nicely. It's all done. Anything that doesn't open fully, like a T-shirt or a top or even just a coat, because a coat is a bit more like maneuver. You have to do a bit more like putting your arm behind you. It's just awful.
Yeah, I mean, even for my MRI scan, I remember you normally put in a T-shirt to do it. No, like, yeah, that's not going to work for you. So I was wearing a kimono of some sort.
Nice. Sort of silk floral number.
Yeah, it felt quite classy in the same way.
Yeah.
So I was rammed into the dark tube.
I mean, I have actually sort of experienced a similar thing to you of not really wanting to take painkillers for it. I don't know whether it's some kind of like misplaced bit of masculinity or I don't know. It's that idea, isn't it, that it's kind of weak or... I don't know, I always feel like, oh no, I won't take them. I'll save it until I really need them.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is a sort of an absurd thing to do with paracetamol.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think I'm treating paracetamol like a pretty heavy opioid. Because, yeah, with the opioids, yeah, I get it. You don't want to overdo that. But paracetamol, you're fine.
I'm just sitting there thinking, no, I won't take this ibuprofen. What if it turns out I need the ibuprofen? You know, what if I have to take it for weeks and weeks and weeks and it's going to mess me up? Just not really a very rational thought process.
No. Actually, the one defense against that I've heard from an actual doctor is that what you do is you cycle between paracetamol, ibuprofen, and beer. So you take one of them every 4 hours, just keep going in a rotation. They don't interfere with each other anyway. Mm. All of them you can take once every 12 hours with no ill effects.
Nice.
And they use slightly different ways of killing the pain, so then they all overlap nicely. And so,
I like the beer idea. That sounds nice. So I don't know. I mean, we need to talk about what we've learned, don't we, from our various injuries. That's what our podcast is all about.
Yeah, yeah.
What have we learned?
No one wants a full hour of us bitching about our shoulders. Like,
oh my God, it's so painful.
It was really painful. Yeah. I wasn't expecting. I had to have a little lie down.
If you had to have a lie down, I'm not just blowing smoke up your ass, but if you had to have a lie down, that means it was bad. You're very you're very stoical about physical things.
It's unmanly lying down because of pain.
Yeah. you're a stoic kind of guy. You know, it's something I admire. I'm much more stoic than I am about physical things. But
well, I broke character on this occasion.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas I've just been sort of moping around, you know, crying out
but
for sympathy.
Still not taking paracetamol.
Yeah, but that would be weak. Yeah, I know. I'm a mess of contradictions. So what have I learned? I have learned that it's much better being uninjured than it is being injured. And you don't appreciate it enough when you are uninjured, that you are uninjured. It's a bit like being really unwell, isn't it? You just don't appreciate it. Or really hungover. You just don't appreciate. You realise that you don't appreciate it enough.
You don't notice these things when they're all working. It's only when they stop working that you notice them and suddenly...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's one. That's one thing I've learned. I think the other things that I've learned is just the... I remember reading that thing that you sent me a while ago about the guy. I can never remember these words. It's like Brahma and the... What's it? The sort of the Buddhist thing about... The reality and the veil.
What was it called?
I can't remember.
Eric Pearl article.
Yeah. Anyway, it's all about the
Alec Baldwin in. No, I'm going to search because this is actually one of the best essays I've ever read.
Well, while you're doing that, if I can give the overall concept. So it's the idea that most of the time we are paying attention to and we are concerned with and our minds are filled with things that are actually mundane, illusory, not particularly important, and nothing to do really with the fundamental realities of life. But then,
they are important, but they're abstractions, like you know, money and status and things.
But then sometimes something happens that intrudes and pierces that sort of veil. And it's because it's like real reality sort of piercing the veil. So, you know, like a bad injury is one of those things that suddenly makes you realise that, oh my God, no, that's actually really fundamental and important. And all of this other stuff that I've been paying attention to is a kind of a second order of importance. Like the real importance is this. And I think that your own physical, you know, your own body, it doesn't get much more real than that. And when you suddenly realise that your body isn't something that you can is not invincible, and it is breakable. You're kind of suddenly like, oh my God, I've only got one body. Please fix, please heal.
Yeah. So here's the quote from that that article. So this is from the intrinsicperspective.com, which is a neuroscientist blog. The article is called Baldwin and Brahman because it's all about the time Alec Baldwin shot that person on the set of Rust. Where the idea there is that he was, you know, going along as we all normally do, and then suddenly you're confronted by reality. You know, someone just died.
Yeah.
So, to steal a term from Hinduism, we spend most of our days in Maya, that which is not, the illusion. Maya is your job and the email you don't want to answer and your worry about politics and the thing you're mad about on Twitter. The opposite of Maya is Brahman, or absolute reality. It's not on any map, but, as Melville said, true places never are. For you can indeed find Brahman, or, far more likely, it finds you. Some sterile space with fluorescent lighting and coffee in little cardboard cups from a break room with vending machines. That's where life actually happens, because that's where death actually happens. Yeah.
Powerful
so,
stuff.
Yeah, you, yeah, no, yeah, great article. Yeah. But, yeah, you suddenly find yourself, even in, you know, a minor part of Brahman, hurty shoulder rather than a loved one dying.
Yeah.
But it's all on a spectrum.
Yep. So I've definitely noticed that. You're worried about some things, you know, your head is full of something, but then when you're really in pain, you're suddenly like, oh my God, why was I worrying about that? Like, there's nothing worse than pain. So those are the sort of some preliminary thoughts. What do you have anything to add to that?
Go a bit further. So that thing about, you know, not appreciating something you have until it's broken. I almost end up going further than that, in that you obviously keep yourself in superb shape, or as my brother says, you've got a great rig.
Stop it.
Anyway, I don't. my worry is that, you know, I've taken a slightly more relaxed approach to fitness, or I sort of assume that fitness will happen. And it has happened when I've had jobs that, you know, are fundamentally active. You know, when I was a water sports instructor, I was in great shape. I think my genes say I should either be a warrior or a farmer. And in both cases, you're not having to actually go to a gym. But now with an email job, I've been in denial about the fitness repercussions of that for some time. I've got that extra thing. If I didn't realize that, you know, the shoulder was quite valuable until I lost it. Well, are there some things that I don't have in my normal state that I perhaps would have if I got jacked? This has been compounded by as part of my rehabilitation. So firstly, I was going to a physio to improve range of motion and the various movements. But at some point, you've got to actually strengthen up your shoulder again. I've always prided myself on my shoulder strength, and I've done a lot of sports that involve a lot of shoulder work. So I thought, okay, I'll get a personal trainer. I'm going to do this. This personal trainer works in a philosophy based on some 1970s bodybuilder called Mike Mensa. So I've ended up going on a bit of a rabbit hole down his readings, and he was one of those kind of philosopher bodybuilders where he also had, you know. Yeah, I think you spend a lot of time not bodybuilding if you're a bodybuilder. When you're not in the gym, you have to rest, and so you appreciate art and read philosophy, I think, if you're and the bodybuilding is supposed to be an expression of, you know, what it is to be a great man.
Right.
So I've been reading around that, and also it's extremely Greek.
Yeah.
And along a similar theme, I've just read Sun and Steel by Yukio Mishima, which is the book that allegedly radicalized PewDiePie and turned him into a right-wing bodybuilder when before he was a left-wing dweeb. He was a YouTuber. And that was something similar. This guy, he wrote a book that was called something like the Sailor Who Fell from Grace from the Sea or something like that. He wrote a lot of, you know, sort of famous, you know, literary short Japanese books that are well regarded by people whose opinions I don't trust. But this book is mental because it's basically about how, from an early age, he knew he wanted to have a beautiful death. You know, just when he was at his absolute peak, intellectually and artistically, then he wanted to die. And then he suddenly realized that the death couldn't be beautiful if he wasn't jacked. Like, he just couldn't. You know, he was trying to imagine this death, which was probably going to be ritual suicide in the Japanese manner. And then he sort of looked at his own body and tried to imagine it in that situation, and it just didn't work at all.
So he had to get,
yeah,
right.
It wouldn't be a beautiful death if his body wasn't beautiful.
Yeah.
So he's started getting jacked to address that, so that he could have a beautiful death. How did I get onto this?
Well, I mean, it's the sort of
Basically, yeah, I've been going down a kind of bodybuilding, self-improvement, intellectual rabbit hole at this point, because I've got some way to go Again, you know, we've mentioned how much a shoulder does. Like, the exercise in the gym are on embarrassingly low weights at the moment, partly because my form's dreadful in general, but also partly because my shoulder fails long before anything else fails.
Yeah. But you've got this reading to keep you going. You know, you're
exactly. Through the
you're not just training. You're undertaking an aesthetic, a philosophical, and intellectual series of exercises as well.
Exactly, and the guy said, "Well, how can you have a powerful intellect, or how can you sort of write powerfully if your body isn't powerful? You don't really know what it feels like to be powerful if your body is weak."
Yeah, that's interesting.
And that it sort of hit a bit of a nerve. So one of the
I do worry that there's some kind of ideology that's sort of
lurking
like a sort of Trojan horse kind of in this, and I'm not quite sure that it's going to be a very healthy one.
So some studies came to my notice recently which show that the more jacked you get, the more right wing you get.
Right.
No, there's just a very clear correlation.
Yeah, I can believe that. Yeah.
Watch my ideological development with interest.
Okay. Moving further to the right.
Further still.
Interesting. Yeah. Go on.
Well, one of the great consequences of my broken shoulder is becoming more right wing.
Right.
I think. Well, I assume I'll get there once I've brought my body up to where it ought to be, or where it could be.
It's just made me think of the Iliad, where I think it's Priam who says that he's complaining that I think he's thinking that he's looking forward to his own death, and you know, he's an old man, and he says, "Look, it's fine for young men to die. They get torn by the spear on the battlefield, and they lie there in their beauty, and all is as it should be, you know. But an old man, he's died, and it's a piteous and hideous thing that the people avert their eyes from. It's a shameful thing." And he's very much talking about the way the bodies look as they're sort of torn and pierced and sort of thing. So it's, I mean, obviously...
It's the overall aesthetic as well, because it's right for young men to die on the battlefield. Or I don't know, I mean, Mishima was coming from a similar angle, and I think he'd read a lot of this ancient Greek stuff, or he certainly refers to it a lot. And one thing is, he came of age just after the Second World War, where obviously you'd seen the kamikazes, the suicide squads kind of go off for a glorious death, and I mean, a lot of glorious death was happening on the Japanese side. And he felt like he sort of missed an opportunity, and like, now that you know Japan wasn't allowed an army, where was the opportunity to have a beautiful death? You just get old and you fade away.
Yeah, interesting. I find this interesting. I'm not personally endorsing this philosophy in any way.
I have no intention of committing ritual suicide.
It's very interesting as a sort of a set of ideas, because it's so counterintuitive to a lot of our kind of basic assumptions in the West, isn't it, about what is good and what's worthwhile.
Except, of course, as you often say, the Iliad is one of our foundational documents, and in that, beautiful death is very much, and I think in you know our pagan ancestors in the cold Northwest Europe.
One thing that we do,
a warrior's have, death was.
I think that what we've taken from it is a kind of Greek obsession with the sort of the perfect masculine form. We've also kind of got this thing about the perfect feminine form that the Greeks didn't really have, but definitely, you know, what we think of as the perfect masculine form is a Greek creation. And it's a sort of trite point, but the Greeks did invent the gym, literally. and they invented it both as a kind of a place and as an idea. We do have that, but I think that we've very much, and this is a facet I think that's actually quite recent, really, because I think it's very materialist. We've really turned away from any really thinking about death at all. It's something that we just don't want to deal with, I think, because there's nothing in our dominant intellectual system that allows us to cope with it at all. It just doesn't fit into materialism in any way that works with the human psyche.
Agreed. And actually, in this Eric Pohl essay, the Maya versus Brahman one, he sort of discussed this at length, that we have this aversion. He recalled being in a vet and a guy came in, distraught because his dog needs to be put down. And then sort of the whole family sort of came in and said goodbye to the dog. And then everyone left, leaving the dog to die alone on the vet's table, just because they just couldn't quite bring themselves to look death in the face and accept it. And yeah, he says it's because we live our lives in this much more highly abstracted world than at any time in our development. There's no need. There's no reason to face death because it happens in hospitals.
It happens elsewhere. Yes, it happens elsewhere. Right. Yeah. I think that one of the things that bugs me about this is it's a bit sort of grim and bleak, but the way that we treat people with dementia and Alzheimer's. I mean, I've got a bit of personal experience with this, and it is morally horrendous. It is just absolutely terrible. And it's one of those moral atrocities that happens with everybody thinking that they're trying to do the right thing all around it. Everybody is thinking that they're wanting to do the right thing.
And then this atrocity, are we talking about dumping them in a nursing home and then never seeing them?
Basically. I mean, not even never seeing them, but there's just the whole thing is everyone is trying to do the right thing very sincerely. But because of the underlying social and intellectual structures of materialism and, you know, the society we live in with sort of atomized families and blah, 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 blah. It just is horrendous. It's absolutely horrendous. And that really has hit me powerfully from my own experience. And I think it is all to do with the fact that we do not face up to death. And I know that lots of people have pointed this out about our society. We're not talking about anything new here, but it really is a very stark fact that we don't do that. But to bring it back to what you were saying, I think that it's a really interesting thing here that thinking about death is the sort of the reverse of the coin from thinking about your own physical body and what it means in a kind of philosophical or aesthetic sense on a deeper level.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. And especially, I think a truth that every bodybuilder has to reckon with is that, okay, you're at your peak and then you fall off your peak and you never get it back.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that I really struggle with. I mean, I worked out a lot, and, you know, part of the reason why I do it is for aesthetic reasons, wouldn't deny that. And I like to think it's a kind of a...
Great rig.
Yeah. Please stop saying that. But, I like to think that one of the reasons is because of some of the reasons that you've described there, the idea that actually, you know, it's a good thing to sort of to treat your own physicality seriously and see what you can do with it, you know, it's about self-control and discipline and being, I don't want to sound unbelievably, I don't want to induce vomit any, but sort of seeing what the best version of your own body can be, you know, I think that's interesting.
Yeah.
And it requires a lot of kind of morally good actions, like, you know, as I say, commitment, focus, discipline. Endurance. No, I've never done anything like that. But endurance and, you know, all those things I think are...
Over a long period of time
that I think are moral positives. And, you know, I like to think that's why I do it, as well as the sort of vanity aspect. But
how about status? Would you say it's low status to be overweight and high status to be jacked?
That's an interesting one. I think that... Yeah. I think it's very nuanced. I think that there are contexts in which those statements are true and contexts in which they're not true. We are, you know, as human beings, we're always engaged in positioning on multiple hierarchies at the same time. So there's a sort of, you know, put it crudely, there might be a financial hierarchy, then there might be a physical hierarchy, then there might be a sort of, I don't know, charisma hierarchy, a professional hierarchy, and all of these are overlapping and they're all intertwined and they're all happening at the same time. And I think that if you are quite high on quite a few hierarchies in that mix, it can sort of cancel out the physical hierarchy thing, because people think, well, you know, X guy over there, he's not overweight because he's poor or rubbish or low status. He's overweight because he just doesn't care about it.
No one's calling Elon Musk low status, are they?
No, exactly.
But the flip side of that is that I don't think anyone listened to what Andrew Tate has to say if he wasn't jacked.
No, that's true.
It almost gives you some authority from which to speak, especially when you're talking about things like discipline and strength and power.
Well, I suppose it makes sense, doesn't it? Because if you're struggling on some of the hierarchies, but there is one hierarchy that is completely within your control, if you're willing to to take control of it, then you are going to take, you know, what Andrew Tate is offering on it, I think on a sort of subliminal level, is he's saying, like, to all of his followers, yeah, you're not very high on all of these hierarchies and you don't really stand a chance of being so, but, you know, look at me, I'm showing a way of being high on a particular hierarchy, and anybody can access that, you know, as long as you are sort of able-bodied. And that's very appealing to a lot of young men who are, you know, in the lower quadrants of the socioeconomic sort of hierarchy, as we say.
Yeah. And it's also an honest signal because he's done it. He's not telling people to do it. You can see that, you know, this is something he's worked very hard on.
Mm. Does it make me feel more high status? Only in the lowest, meanest, most contemptible sense. I mean, I'm very aware that, you know, it doesn't. I remember having some very embarrassing thoughts when I was younger, when I was, you know, when we were in London and, you know, I was working a job that I hated and I particularly didn't like some of my bosses. Yeah. And I remember sort of thinking, well, they might be wealthy, but look at them. You know,
and, I mean, fair enough, isn't it?
You know,
they will never have youth and beauty again.
Yeah, and I look back on that now with a sort of bit of pity for the younger me, because obviously that's a very crude and not very admirable way of seeing the world. And clearly, really, I was just resentful of their higher status, and I found a way to sort of rationalise it to myself.
Yeah, but they were also terrible human beings, and it's interesting that they were terrible human beings and looked terrible. Whereas you, of course, of great virtue. And
I'm not so sure about that.
Had a great rig, so...
I don't think so. I do recall that very much. But the thing you were saying about the idea of the notion of you as a somebody who does this, that you've got to accept that there is a point at which you will be at your peak and it cannot be maintained.
Yeah.
I think that is really interesting for me.
Because with your intellect, you feel that it can keep growing until you hit about 85. So actually, that peaks as well. But a lot later. But yeah, your body.
Because I think that there's something that's very nourishing to oneself and one's sense of self about that phase in which you're making sort of progress or gains. And like, you know, you're getting fitter and stronger and better and bigger and all of those kind of things. And that has its own rewards. And it's very, as I say, it's very, you know, nourishing for one's ego and sense of self and all of that kind of thing. But then the process of sort of steadily losing it, I think that's probably a much more bracing
working just as hard just to kind of cling onto it.
I think that you clearly have to accept it at some point, don't you? And you have to, it's like, it's going to be managed decline. I think that that is a much more profound moral test, is whether you can make that decision of saying, it's time for me to start to just manage the decline now. I am past my peak. That must take a lot of moral and personal courage. And
but if you conquer that, then I think the rest of your life is going to be a lot better. So this to me is another reason to get jacked, so that you have that memento mori.
It's a memento. You're spot on. It's
like
a memento
time
mori.
Is running out. Yeah. Like, yeah.
And that's the link to death again, isn't it? You're spot on. It is a memento mori. It's like, I have achieved this ephemeral sort of efflorescence. And now, but I can only have it for such a short period of time in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah.
And, you know, who's going to see it other than you, really? I mean, your brother clearly has seen, has seen me, which I'm very gratified for, especially now I've done my shoulder and it's all going to go. But
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Kiss goodbye to that, yeah.
Yeah. For what it is, which is not actually as impressive as naive listeners might think. But interesting. I've done this. I've been involved in this project myself in terms of, you know, working out and all of that kind of thing for actually decades. I mean, I've done this since I was my mid teens. So it's been a long, and I do worry, you know, this injury, to bring it back to the injuries, I do worry that this injury is a sign that I am just getting old, like my body can't take it anymore, that I've worn it out, you know, that I've done so many press-ups that my body's just like, well, you've done it. You've done all the press-ups.
Yeah, like, you had your lifetime allowance. Yeah, and then, yeah.
I am a bit worried about that it's a sort of a sign of impending, because my knee is actually a bit out as well. I haven't been able to run because
Well, you do a lot of running recently. As well.
Yeah, I must have run. I must have done an average of 5K a week for the last 20 years, I reckon. That's quite a lot of K.
Yes, there's a lot of K.
So, you know, I've never been a super long distance runner, but I have done it for a long time. I've always been a fast runner. I just worry that my body is actually just being like, no, you've had it. You've had your quota. You've maxed it out on all of your mileage. You know, your mileage is too high.
Yeah, it's the life of the mind for you now.
Yeah. Yeah. So it is an interesting sort of thought. It's a definitely feeling, because I'm going to be I'm going to be 35 this year. I'm going to be closer to 40 than 30. So it's definitely something that's around the edges of my mind. But
yeah, well, what do I do about it? So I'm radicalizing myself.
Yeah. I'm not going to be advocating ritual suicide anytime soon. But
I know, read the book. He presents a powerful argument.
Okay. I have always thought, though, I remember reading about a philosopher in the United States who basically has made the claim that he is going to refuse all medical treatment after the age of 75. So, you know, if he sprains his ankle or something, like he will get medical treatment for that. But anything that is potentially life-threatening, like, you know, flu or cancer or, you know, something like that, he's going to refuse treatment for it. Because in his mind, these treatments, after a certain age, lead to a bad death because they prolong the life unnecessarily, and we don't have the technology to make the life good quality.
Well, yeah, you swap 6 good months for 5 terrible years.
Yeah,
I think is the deal you're making when you're having a major surgery at that kind of age. We can keep you long. We can keep you alive now for a very long time. But it will suck.
Yeah, it will suck exactly. And I think that I'm very attracted to that ethic. Personally, I would never try and force it on anyone else. I don't really believe in that. I'm very much a kind of liberty kind of person, but. For me, just for me personally, I think that makes a lot of sense. I've thought about it a lot. I think that, I hope I do have the courage to do that, because I think it's right on many, many, many different levels. So I guess that is my own sort of, in a way, I am already along the path to radicalization like you, aren't I, in terms of the notion of, the embracing a particular type of death.
But it's interesting, we say all this, I'm still strongly against euthanasia laws along the lines of Canada's.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you about that, because that's the next logical thought, isn't it? I mean, what's the difference there? Clearly there is a difference, but I'm genuinely interested in how you would...
That's what I'm wondering as well, because, surely this is the fix.
I think there's a massive, massive moral difference between making a choice yourself and other people being involved.
Exactly, whether that's the state or your own family. Because, if it's your family sort of encouraging you to shuffle off, or not even that, but sort of everyone finds themselves in a position where the old person feels like they're a burden and so feels pressure to end it earlier than they would have liked to. That is horrible. And then it's having the state doing the killing as well, or somehow having the state involved, having a judge sign the order. It's like, if you're going to do it, at least be sovereign, rather than getting permission from the government and then having a doctor administer
that
something.
That's the bit you're really objective, isn't it?
The
bureaucracy.
That is not a beautiful death.
Do you think that in order for it to be just or good or beautiful or whatever you want to call it, that there has to be... it has to come from one's own personal beliefs and, as it were, virtue. You know, it has to be your courage or your resolution or your personal, yeah, sovereignty. I guess sovereignty is the word, isn't it? Do you think that's a key element and a key difference then?
Well, you know, how sovereign is the warrior on the battlefield? You know, Priam's probably pretty sovereign, but the rank and file.
Well, for in the Iliad, the heroes are very sovereign. Very sovereign.
Most of the dying was not heroes.
Well, for the Greeks, of course, that's not something that would bother them at all, because they don't have a notion of souls and souls coming from God and therefore human equality or the sacredness of human life. So it doesn't... for the ancient Greeks, your worth, your value, you know, was contingent upon your status, and that's your sort of biological... I don't know what's the right word. Your physical status as well as your socioeconomic... We would think of it as socioeconomic, but they would think of it as... I don't know, your innate nature, whether you are a hero or a commoner or whatever. That wouldn't bother them at all. But for us, it does, because we have a notion that all human life is sacred and in some sense equal, which derives from Christianity and the belief in souls. So I don't know. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I guess so. I'm just thinking about your sovereignty question.
Yeah.
Because I think natural deaths are good. And the problem is, I guess, the sort of bad deaths we have now are the result of trying to cling on to life.
Yes, 100%. I think it's not really
knowing what life is or what it's for.
Yes, it's the lack of the ability to face up to the fact that we are mortal and will die. I see it in... You know, I don't know whether I'm being unfair here, but I see it particularly in our parents' generation, a real, real, you know, aversion from thinking about or talking about death in a sort of rational, calm way, which baffles me because for me, my instinct is that I would really, really want to talk about it because I really, really don't want to rubbish death. You know,
matters quite a lot.
You know, I am going to die. There's no avoiding it. So it makes sense. It doesn't make sense to me to get upset about it in quite the same way.
Yeah, or if you are upset about it, it's something you need to face up to as soon as possible.
Yeah.
Because it's not going away. Like, it's just something you need to have in order.
Yeah.
Otherwise, your whole life is going to be blighted by it. Or you'll miss opportunities, or you'll let life pass you by because you don't believe it's going to end.
Yeah, and I don't think that... I'm not trying to say that I'm somehow, like, unafraid of death. Of course, like, we all have this kind of base biological fear that I'm as prey to as much as anybody else. But on an intellectual level, I can honestly, hand in heart, say that I don't think I am afraid of it at all. I'm not just trying to blow smoke up my own backside here. I guess it's something that I do think about quite a lot, but not in a sort of grim way. And maybe that is linked to the fact that, you know, some of my other choices in life, like, you know, exercising a lot.
That's the thing. It does confronting it lead to healthier life choices, like exercising a lot, like getting on with life?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it definitely has been a part of, you know, my decision to settle down and start a family.
Yeah, because, actually probably the earlier the better for that sort of thing. And
it just seems like the natural thing, once you realise that you are going to die, doesn't it? It just seems like the natural thing to do.
Given it's going to happen, the sooner the better, really.
I'm not trying to be prescriptive to anyone here. I'm just talking about my own experience, but I don't know, it does seem to make sense to me.
When you've acted decisively in your career as well, like, you pulled the plug rather than spending 3 years sort of going down a funnel.
But I'd say, one of the interesting things is that I don't think I'm particularly physically brave. Because I'd say that you're very good at being sort of very physically brave in the sense that you don't really pay much attention to your own potential discomfort at all.
But does that mean that I'm also not really paying attention to the fact I'll die? And I'm therefore making less good decisions, given that I will.
Well, I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, this whole shoulder issue has made me question this. Yeah. You know, maybe I should exercise more. Yeah.
But I think that you're right that your personality is not, you're not somebody who would spend hours in a gym in front of a mirror. It's just not your personality. You know, you would be,
no.
But you would spend hours out in a field in the snowstorm long after I would have gone in for a bath and a cup of soup, and you'd still be out there having a great time. Like, genuinely.
Yeah, no, fully agree. But sadly, the modern world gives you the opportunity to do curls in front of a mirror, and it does not give me the opportunity to do arbitrary tasks in the distance. strenuous and rewarding, yeah.
Ah, the oxen is frozen to death. I will. No worries.
Yeah.
No matter.
But it's not that I will. It's like I have to. It's like you're forced into these feats.
Anyway, to bring it back to the to what we were discussing, the injury and how it makes you reflect on life. I think that what has it done for me? I mean, it's just made me realise that I can't. I've got to face up to the fact that I am not 23. I need to make sensible decisions about what my body can do, and try not to get stressed about the fact that I'm not able to exercise. That's that flip side of the whole moral value here. As we were saying, it's easy accessing the moral value of getting better at something and getting faster and getting stronger, because it's just that's obviously great. But the real moral challenge is handling the downside, the decline, the periods of, you know, the fallow periods. That's the real moral challenge, I think. I'm gonna have to try and face up to that. I think that's what I've
especially since, as Mike Mentzer tells me, cortisol is the enemy of gains. Like, if you get stressed, then your body will just fall apart.
Yeah, I've got to. I've just got to be not stressed.
Yeah, it's quite funny. So your reaction has been, "I'm getting old," whilst mine has been more like, "You're still young, get on with it," or "We still fix this."
Yeah.
It feels more like kick up the arse for me.
But I think they are two sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
The point.
Yeah, they're both acknowledging that the current state is finite.
Yeah, exactly, and I guess I've got to be able to learn to do what you are able to do, which is just be comfortable with, you know, taking things as they come and being comfortable with it. And,
you know, and I need to learn what you do, which is doing curls in front of a mirror.
I don't actually do them in front of a mirror. I don't have a mirror. perhaps I would, if I'm being honest, if I had the ability. I don't know, maybe just to check my form. It's only to make sure that the form is right.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's legit. It's fine.
You're about to say something more profound than the
No, just that, you know, as I say, like, we're both trying to learn the bit that we're not naturally good at. For you, it's the sort of the arbitrary discipline of homework.
I've never been good at that.
No. And then for me, it's what I have always been really good at. I remember you called it, very disparagingly once, called it trench warfare, which I've never forgotten. I just see what's in your head, which is that you're this kind of dashing cavalry commander, while I'm this sort of mud-soaked sort of, you know, infantryman. And though I may win in the end, you know, there's no honour in it. I know exactly what was in your mind.
I apologise.
And I've got to learn to sort of just take things as it come and not sort of be not trying to control everything. That's it. I mean, it's about not control. For me, it's about I've got to learn
that
I can't control everything.
And I've got to learn that I probably ought to control some stuff. There's probably a middle way.
Okay, well, that's been a nice episode about personal growth, hasn't it?
Yeah, a lot about death.
A little segue through problematic philosophies and Japanese ritual suicide. Hopefully it doesn't get us cancelled.
Yeah, and yeah. In fairness to him, he did actually carry through with it.
I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Well, it's consistent.
It's a thing.
Consistency is good.
Yeah, it's a notable thing. Yeah, yeah. And how many of us do things that are notable? Still, though, I still don't agree with radical suicide philosophies, just to be absolutely clear.
Yeah, I've still got some work understanding Japanese culture.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel there's something there.
Well, is that? I mean, that's a different area of discussion. Is that Japanese culture now, or is it that? Mm. Is that a relic?
Or have they been neutered? Yeah.
Well, just changed. I mean, I don't know.
I know you watch the Studio Ghibli films, and you're like, there's something. You know, it's still got an edge of some sort.
The edge is a different type of edge now, isn't it? It's a kind of a stranger edge, stranger from our perspective, at least.
Less torturing of prisoners.
But that's what makes Japan so magnetic to people, you know. That's why people are so in awe of its culture. I mean, it's just different. Anyway, discussion for another time.
Yes.
Good. Okay, well, I hope the recovery continues, and I hope that you...
likewise.
I hope the gains start to flow.
Hope your physio heals miracles.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, we'll see. I'll keep you updated. Bye for now.
Bye.
To put this episode into full context, 3 days later, my co-host went to the physio. She dug her thumb into his shoulder, and he was completely fine after that.